The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Glenn Beck.
Out of all of the infuriating things about America right now, there is one that rests high above, towers over all the others. Of course, I don't even need to say it. You can say it with me. It is, of course, the looming problem of
terrorism.
No, Chick-fil-A.
Oh.
Chick-fil-A. Okay, remember, the late founder of this restaurant chain had the audacity to believe in the American dream. Wow. Now, imagine the audacity of Truett Cathy and his company, and the audacity of his company to exploit America's free market system by making a good product that people actually want to buy. Imagine that. Then to slowly grow their business over several decades from a single family-run restaurant to the third largest fast food chain in America behind McDonald's and Starbucks, providing hundreds of thousands of jobs along the way. How dare they? But I haven't even scratched the surface of the evil of Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A remains closed on Sundays. As if this was still the Eisenhower era where it was common to believe in God or something. Now, by closing on Sundays, Chick-fil-A is clearly preaching the Bible. Now, I haven't been to Chick-fil-A lately, but I have done my homework here just in the last couple of days because The New Yorker is very upset about Chick-fil-A, so I haven't seen it myself, but I am sure that they are checking your Jesus card before you're allowed to place an order, right? No shirt, no shoes, no savior, no service. New. What backward hicks? I mean, we can't allow this to go on, can we? Well, we can in the South, but now they've crossed the line, okay? Now they've dared to open 4 locations in Manhattan. Hello! Don't you realize that we have declared that island godless? And you are not allowed to have pickles on your chicken sandwich, because we all know that is pointing to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Now, this tragedy, I read the description by Dan Pippenberg. He's one of my favorite Pippenberger Bring or something. I love all of his writings in the New Yorker, and he wrote over the weekend. And you know, I see his point. It's almost as if Nazi recruitment centers had opened in Manhattan. His article is titled "Chick-fil-A's Creepy Infiltration of New York City." And that is the feeling I get from Chick-fil-A. Creepiness. You know what I mean? Especially cows. Cows with paintbrushes on billboards? How'd they get up there? How do they hold the brush? It's that kind of creepiness that really is freaking me out. But that's not what he's talking about. He, of course, is talking about Chick-fil-A's, quoting, pervasive Christian traditionalism. Man. He says their headquarters in Atlanta are adorned with Bible verses and a statue of Jesus washing a disciple's feet. First of all, whoa, in New York? Really? No, it's in Atlanta. But in New York, you have to hear about stories about a statue of a Jew doing service to his fellow man? Oh my gosh, all the humanity. Now, he says that Bible pounding is just below the surface at Chick-fil-A. To think that this poor man and other New Yorkers have to step inside one of these Jesus indoctrination chicken centers for this story assignment. I don't know how he did it. It's cruel and unusual punishment. This progressive has a problem with Chick-fil-A because its founder believed in something. Wow. Well, it doesn't sound very tolerant, and I'm sure the New Yorker, I mean, let's imagine that Wendy's founder, Dave Thomas, was a Muslim. Let's go further to the point of ridiculousness that we didn't know that Wendy had red hair or freckles because she had to wear a burqa and a headscarf. Now, do you think the New Yorker, even at that point of ridiculousness, would talk about the creepy indoctrination that is going on with Wendy's? No. They would celebrate the diversity, wouldn't they? He wrote, "There's something especially distasteful about Chick-fil-A, which has sought to portray itself as better than other fast food, cleaner, gentler, more ethical." Oh my gosh! The worst thing that could happen is somebody trying to portray themselves as that. He's clearly freaked out that someone would dare integrate aspects of their faith and values in how they run their country, their company. I know it's not usually done. I know we don't even usually take our faith and try to live by it in our day-to-day life. But here's a company that shows, yeah, it can be done. Typical of today's journalist, he never pauses to consider that perhaps those ingredients, and not the Colonel's secret herbs and spices, but these well-known ingredients are the reasons why Chick-fil-A lines wrap around the block. And yes, as creepy as it is, even in New York City, Batman.
It's Monday, April 16th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
I am hoping that Amy Chua can spend some time with us today. She has written a book called Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. She is the John Duff Professor of Law at the Yale Law School. She graduated from Harvard. Amy, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. I don't know how much time you have, but I would love to spend as much time as you have.
I have time.
Okay. Your book is great because you talk about the secret of America and how we're really kind of violating that now, really strangely, unknowingly. But you speak to both sides of the aisle, so we can kind of hear each other. It's not a book written from the left or from the right,
and
it's trying to speak the language of both sides. And let's start with the essential goodness of America that you point out.
Right. So I'm not even trying to be both sides. I am just kind of going back. I think we all need to remember what it is that makes America special. And so I actually have spent 20 years studying different countries in the developing world, you know, European countries. And believe it or not, there is something really special about America that I think most Americans don't even realize. Mm-hmm. And I say that we alone among the major powers, not France, not England, we are what I call a supergroup. And to be a supergroup, Glenn, it's really simple. You only need to do two things. The first is to have a really strong, overarching national identity, just something that holds us together, Americans. But the second requirement for a supergroup is we have to allow all different kinds of subgroup identities to flourish. So it's like, so in this country, you can be, you know, you can say, I'm Irish American, I'm Italian American, I'm Croatian American, I'm Japanese American, and still be intensely patriotic at the same time. And believe it or not, this is not true in a country like France. Like, you wouldn't say, I'm Italian French. There's no such thing. You know, and right now, because of the tribalism that has taken over our political system, we're starting to destroy that. We're starting to destroy this connective tissue, this big overarching national identity that we have that is what's made us special. And, you know, your example, you really about Chick-fil-A is also there's an attack on allowing individual subgroup identities to flourish,
right,
too. So it's a dangerous moment for us.
So I thought this was really fascinating. And the most clear I've heard anybody state this, you're saying that a lot of these wars that we have engaged in are unwinnable simply because those nations don't have a supergroup.
Exactly. So one thing that America has done, and so, you know, my real field for 20 years has been, again, looking at foreign policy. And what I try to say is I explain why we have messed it up so much in countries from Vietnam to Afghanistan to Iraq. And a lot of it has to do with we don't realize how exceptional our own identity and history is. So we forget how unusual it is to be this multi-ethnic nation with so many different ethnicities and to have a really strong American identity. So, Glenn, why do you think Libya is now a failed state? We miss this. President Obama actually really honorably conceded this. He said we failed to see the depth of the tribalism. Libya was a multi-ethnic country like we are, 140 different ethnic groups. But the difference is that Libya didn't have a strong enough national identity. This idea of being a Libyan didn't matter to these people. And it just fell apart. It fell apart after we intervened, and we didn't see that. We thought, you know what? They're going to be like us.
Yeah.
If we just take out this horrible dictator and then we leave and put in democracy, it's going to come together. And it didn't happen.
So
we project that we forget how special we are, and we make mistakes by forgetting that other countries are not like us.
And it seems in a sick sort of twisted way, we understood this with our motivation behind the Sykes-Picot lines and agreement in the Middle East, where we drew these country lines knowing that it would cause warring factions and the dictators would be so busy trying to keep their own tribe together that
right.
they wouldn't have time to look out. We know this at one point.
Well, you know what's so funny? The British were the masters of this, actually, because
right.
the British, they, morally, of course, that's another question, but how were they so successful in maintaining this empire for centuries with such a small number of people? I mean, just a handful of British administrators in places like India and the Middle East, exactly what you said. They were masters. They were so conscious of all these little group divisions. But they used it to divide. And you're right. You know, they were like, okay, how can we keep these people at bay? And they actually purposely pitted groups against each other. But we were not like that after we went to the world stage, you know, post-World War II. We actually started to increasingly think of democracy as like this magic formula, you know,
mm-hmm.
that if we, because democracy historically has worked so well for us. So for the idea, we went into Iraq thinking, Sunni, Shias, Kurds, okay, it's kind of a mess, but let's just have some elections. And that was so wrong-headed, because what I've shown is that under certain conditions, democracy can actually worsen group conflict,
sure.
not make it better.
Sure. Okay, so I want to go to the part of the book where you talk about how the left isn't listening to the right and the right isn't listening to the left, and you describe, especially for a professor, I'm just shocked that you're even allowed to teach.
Let's see if I get to go back.
you describe what happened with the Trump voter and what's happening with the Trump voter, and try to explain that to a person on the left. And I've not heard anyone in the media do this and do it effectively as you did. And what we're supposed to learn from this, and how you describe the left to the right when we come back. The name of the book is Political Tribes. Amy Chua is with us. Don't hold it against her that she's a Yale professor. She just said, I don't know if they're going to let her back in, but it's a remarkable book.
Glenn Beck.
Amy Chua, she is an author of the book Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. In your book, you talk about the left believes that the right-wing tribalism, bigotry, racism is tearing the country apart. The right believes that left-wing tribalism, identity politics, political correctness is tearing the country apart. And they're both right. Can you explain?
Right. So, you know, I'm a kind of person that believes that people are basically good and that so many things that go crazy and that end up being awful and are now ripping us apart actually started off with good intentions that were positive things. So, for example, let's start with the left. Progressives, you know, in the 60s and 70s, a lot of their rhetoric was about equality, and they had a very inclusive. It was about let's include everybody, let's transcend groups so that we don't see skin color. But what happened is that right around in the 70s and 80s, a lot of people on the left started thinking, you know what, all these calls for let's not see groups, let's be equal and all this are actually not helping us. And so you started to see people as the, you know, minorities grew in number. They're like, look at these histories that we're telling about the United States. We are romanticizing our founders. We're romanticizing the Constitution. We're romanticizing everything. And Glenn, I think that there's some good to that. It's like, we should talk about the fact that our founders, some of them held slaves. We do have to talk about our native populations. But what happened is they just started going way, way too far. So now if you fast forward to 2018, it's all the way at the other extreme. It's like America is a land of oppression. It's not just like, look, we have this wonderful Constitution with these incredibly important principles, which we have repeatedly failed to live up to, which I believe. Instead, it's like this whole thing is a sham. The country is built on white supremacy, and that is playing with poison because it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So that's one thing that's happened. It goes back to what I was saying is where it's attacking that precious American identity, not saying we need to strive to make it better and to make it reality, but just saying, you know what, let's just throw the whole thing out. And with identity politics, another thing that's happened is, and again, I understand where the left came from. They were like, you know, all this group blind stuff is just being used to block affirmative action. It's just being used by the right to not let us make any changes. Well, fast forward, it's gone too far. In 2018 now, on a college campus where I teach, it's all about groups. If you try to be group transcending, you will immediately be called a racist. Because the idea is that you are trying to erase all the very individual examples of group oppression that we've had. But the problem is that the groups are dividing smaller and smaller. And even worse than that, the idea is like, you cannot understand me. You cannot speak for me. And on top of that, the final thing that drives me craziest is the vocabulary policing. So I feel like a lot of people, you know, in the middle of the country who are not on these Ivy League campuses, they are good-willed. They may be anxious about immigration. They may be anxious about our country changing. You know, they may have certain views that I would disagree with. But that doesn't mean that they're racist and xenophobic and homophobic and whatever. But that's the way it goes right now. It's like if you don't say something exactly right or you don't toe the party line, you're immediately branded all these things. And what that does is it drives a lot of people more extreme underground, where there, I think, is a lot of horrible stuff on the right. And there you hear terrible things, you know. So and it's this vicious cycle. So that's half of it.
Okay, so now let's go, when we come back, let's go to how do we fix it? Because Amy, you're one of the few people I have talked to that I think fully understands the problem that we face. And you have a solution. Next.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
How often do you think about your ears? Not probably that often, right? Well, you should, because if you don't take care of them, you won't be able to listen to me blab every day on the radio. And that is incredibly important to most people. I've started to get serious about my ears. You wear headphones for a living, and you have to do that. It means you got to clean your ears a lot, because if you don't, it's really nasty. It's not a pretty visual, but it's something that everybody has to do. When your ears aren't clean, they can get really uncomfortable. They can itch. They can be painful. Get plugged up, and make it harder to hear. Enter WaxRx. WaxRx comes with everything you need to safely clean out earwax and condition your ears in the comfort of your home for less than the cost of a doctor's visit. This is sort of the system they use at the doctor's offices. It's not Q-tips. They never use Q-tips at a doctor's office. They use something advanced like usewaxrx.com's system. Go there now, usewaxrx.com, order your reusable earwash system today, and use the offer code radio for free shipping. usewaxrx.com, promo code radio, usewaxrx.com.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
We're talking to Amy Chua. She's the author of Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. You also might remember her from Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. Oh, you know, that only sold about 25 zillion copies a few years ago. So she joins us now. Amy's with us.
So, Amy, I have to tell you, I feel like, you know, I'm a brother from another mother with you.
Because
you're... You're so spot on what the problem is, I think, with the political tribes and how we are one half of the country dismisses the other half. We dismiss, you know, the one half of the country dismisses all of the good things that America did. The other half dismisses sometimes all of the bad things that America
exactly.
did. And we've just been pushed further and further apart. So now how do we come together when we each think the other side is the problem?
So there are these fascinating but terrifying studies that I described that show that a lot of this is actually biological, that human beings are tribal animals, that we want, it's almost, and that's not always bad. Family is very tribal, but
right.
positive. And you know,
we had to survive,
exactly.
you know, prehistoric man had to be.
Exactly. So, but there are some scary tests that show that our brains light up when we stick it to the other side. So there's a lot of this, but here's the good news. I have all these studies that show that we can, as human beings, overcome this tribalism. And there are all these very, very robust studies that show that if you can pull human beings out of their group context, because we're worse when with our buddies, you know,
yeah.
And you pull two people from opposite sides, opposite tribes, and have them interact as human beings. It is astounding how much progress can be made. Now, this is not saying just stick people in a room together, because if you put a bunch of diverse people together of different races and backgrounds, they could just hate each other more. The point is having them interact as human beings. And the best example of this is the integration of our military in the 1950s. That was a time when everybody said, no way, this is not going to work. 90% of America was against integrating our military troops. But they did it, and afterwards they found that the integrated troops were as or more effective than the all-white troops. And when they interviewed and conducted all these studies, it was so inspiring. I mean, this is not just black and white. This is like at that time, Italian Americans had never really interacted with Swedish Americans
yes.
and German Americans.
Yes.
But what they said is, you know what, if you throw us all into the same foxhole or the same bunk and we miss our loved ones in the same way, we're terrified in the same way, and we have to trust our lives to this other person, we don't care what accent they have or what color their skin is. And that's a perfect example, because norms really changed and a lot of bad things happened in Vietnam. But one good thing is people start to see each other as human beings. So I have this one idea that a lot of people were excited about. It's going to sound silly, but like a public service program where you take a lot of children from, say, one part of the country where they're always with their own kind, their own privileged people on the coast or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe force, you know, encourage or, you know, have them go to another part of the country and work side by side with other young Americans on a common project, not in a condescending way, like we're going to teach you, you know, but rather just some common infrastructure or some project together. So I think that we really have to think about this. I think we have to change the way we teach our history. I think we've overcorrected. I mean, when you were saying bad and good, you know, we have to tell the truth, but we have to make people feel proud of being part of this country and not forget what makes us so exceptional about it.
But, you know, I have to tell you, Amy, my daughter challenged me once. She said, "Dad, you only know the good stories about America." And I said, "Honey, you've gone to school. You only know the bad stuff."
Right.
And I said, "I'll tell you what. You read the good stuff. I'll read the bad stuff." And by really immersing myself in things like Wounded Knee and really truly understanding it, I've actually come out more hopeful that we can survive anything if we learn from it.
I could not agree with you more. And what I think we're criticizing the same thing because, you know, there's a lot of voices on both the right and the left. It's almost like they want to maintain those tribes. So if you're somebody on the left and you wanted to go to Chick-fil-A or read something positive about George Washington, you're instantly branded by a lot of people. You're bullied. It's like, you're not on our side anymore. You know, and the same thing happens on the right. If somebody on the right wanted to do, you know what, I want to go hear this person speak about Black Lives Matter. No, you can't. And I just think it's that because I wrote this book because I actually have looked at other countries that have actually fragmented and just broken up. And I think that America doesn't realize how precious what we have is. I see people on both sides saying, let's just get a divorce. Let's just break up the country, you know? Yeah. And I think they just don't, they're playing with fire. And I understand that. Sometimes you just get so mad at the other side or what people are saying. And then one extreme thing fuels a more extreme reaction, and it just escalates into a place where people are so hunkered at both sides.
So, Amy, I think what stops us from listening to the other side or sitting down or perhaps it's just saying that you're part of the problem if you do sit down is both sides feel, and I can speak for the right, I think, on this one, is it feels like, you know, we'll sit down and we will tell you the truth, but, you know, the left isn't going to tell us the truth of what their real intent is. And I think there's a difference between the average person in the country and those who are leading these, you know, these groups, you know, where
I totally agree. I think it's actually a lot of very loud, shrill groups, even on a campus. I can say that you'll hear these things that, you know, the rest of America will hear about campus craziness, these crazy things that are said. But when I talk to my students in a private setting, in a smaller group, I find that the majority of them, whether they're on the right or the left, are actually very very reasonable. They may have strong views, but they don't want to demonize. But it's often like a very small number of people, almost like bullying, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, for example, if just like what you just said about, you're a very influential person. So if you just said, you know, I read this book about Wounded Knee or something, try it. You know, that's not a strident thing. It's not taking sides. And I think if even just a few people start to do that, and yes, I think the left is very problematic this way. You know, if somebody, it's not, what I often say is, look, maybe George Washington was a slaveholder, but that's not all he was. You know, it was an amazing story. It was amazing founding. There was so much heroism. And that's like a no-no. You can't say that right now. So there's so much work to be done, and that's partly why I wrote this book.
So, Amy, I have to tell you, I was in, I think it was Denver. Were you with me, Stu?
I think
Denver, and I had just flown in, and an Uber picked me up, and it was a guy who was driving the car, and he was a professor, and he was a professor of Native American studies, and something else, I can't remember what it was, but everything in me went, he hates your guts, Glenn. and I, you know, I would, you know, I was supposed to hate him, I think. But I started talking to him, and he was taking me to a broadcast station, and I could tell that he didn't really like me. And so we just started having a conversation, and I found out that he was from Wounded Knee, that he had done a lot of his studies on Wounded Knee. So we had this great conversation, and he dropped me off at the station, and I said, wait here. When I'm done, I want to show you something. In the back of the car, he didn't know this, but I had one of the 7 Native American guns from Wounded Knee that had been collected.
Wow.
And I told him when we got back in the car, I said, I want to tell you something. I said, I don't know if you know who I am. And he said, oh, I do. and I said, let me tell you what I found about Wounded Knee. And I told him the story. And I said, when we arrive, I want you to open up the back. I have something to show you. And I pulled out the gun and I handed it to him. And he actually wept. He cried.
Wow.
And we hugged each other and we had a great conversation. And we ended up liking each other a lot. That doesn't mean we agree on everything. We saw each other. I stopped seeing him as a professor, and he stopped seeing me as a guy who talks politics. And we saw each other each as people.
I love that. I mean, that's what I was saying. It's like I actually try to do that within my own classes. I have conservative students, believe it or not, they take my classes, and I have a lot of minority students because I'm a minority, and I try to do the same thing. I facilitate it, but I say that, you know, I think we all need to elevate ourselves on both sides of the spectrum and be more generous, because sometimes it's almost like, and again, I get it. You know, it's almost like a game of gotcha. It's very pleasurable to just hate the other side too. You think of sports, you know. I like my story. Your story reminds me of the one I tell that is the same thing. I have this very poor Mexican-American student who is super progressive, who grew up in a trailer park, and he tells a similarly moving story about the people in the next trailer over who were so kind to his family, and they were, you know, very strong Trump supporters that other people would have called white supremacists. But what Gio said is, even though the words they use would, to all my progressive friends, sound horrible and things that they said, at the level of just two human beings, they were the ones that protected us. They were the ones that said, we're going to be here for you. So I love that story.
So we are sitting in a place, you know what, Amy, I'm going to run out of time. We are sitting in a place now to where you just said, I think the key, the language that they might use. We almost speak a different language. I don't know if you're familiar with Jonathan Haidt, but we
completely agree with him.
Yeah, we speak a different language. And I've learned this by going to all kinds of different churches and synagogues and mosques and listening. And I'm amazed that we agree, I think, on 95% of the stuff. But we think we're farther away from each other because of the language that each religion happens to use, and we don't understand it. Coming in, we're like, oh, okay, that's weird. No, it's exactly what you're saying, just said in a different way.
Exactly. But in here again, you know, I think that the left and the right they both have to improve. I have been quite harsh about the left, just all this vocabulary policing.
Yes.
It's like the vocabulary changes all the time, and if you slip up a little bit, you know, then suddenly, aha, we caught you. You're racist. And that's not going to help anybody. But I think what that does is it makes some people on the right go too far in the other direction. They're like, you know what? We're sick of this political correctness, so we're going to say this. And then it makes them purposely say incendiary things that then do sound very terrible. So I think we have to just get out of the vicious cycle and just be more generous towards each. I always say, just try to think about what the person is really trying to say instead of fixating on the exact word. You know, where are they coming from? Are they coming from a good place? Because I see so many people coming from a good place who suddenly just get torn down because they use the wrong word. And again, I think that's more like bullying.
Amy Chua, it is a thrill to talk to you. The name of the book is Political Tribes, Group Instinct and the Fate of Nations. She has not only diagnosed the problem, but she points to the cure. Amy, thanks so much.
So much for having me.
You bet.
Glenn Beck.
Can we see if we can get her on for TV tonight? Because I want to talk to her about race and our race relations in America. Talking about Amy Chua. She is the author of Political Tribes. We just had her on. She's right. I mean, I'm in the middle of, you know, we've been working, a year on a book, and we're just in the middle of it. And I wish I would have read her book before, because I could have just, you know, said, you know, buy her book instead.
Yeah, or you could just take off the cover and put your face on it. and then like just sell it as like yours.
Can we do that?
I mean?
Can we
do that? I mean, if your face is on,
she's a professor of law, but what does she know?
I mean, it would take her buying the book, opening it, and realizing it's her. I mean, she's not going to do that. She's going to see your face in the book and never look at it.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Exactly,
and we sell lots of, and just look, you just have to, maybe we just go through page by page and cross off her name. And write yours in. I think that'll work.
We only sell tens of copies, so.
It's true. I like what she was talking about when it comes to seeing, it's not about gathering like a bunch of people who hate each other in a room and having them scream about politics. You don't get anywhere with that. But when you work with someone, when you do something normal, when you have normal human interactions with people you disagree with.
We had dinner.
Yeah,
Make America dinner again.
Yeah.
We'll see if we have time to talk about this a little bit more. We have a fascinating story coming out of Katy, Texas. A man who says he was bullied by the school superintendent when he was a kid, coming up.
Glenn Beck, Mercury.